from KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
Financial reform at last as Obama heads to the G20, plus the McChrystal Affair. What now in Afghanistan? Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, your moderator, also holding down the political center. Robert Scheer is here on the left. Tony Blankley in Washington on the right. Arianna Huffington is away today. Big news as we went to air this morning. The financial reform came out of conference, the House and Senate passing it on party line votes. It looks like there'll be a vote next week. Robert Scheer, what do you make of it? I assume you've read the 1,200 page.
No, but I've been following it fairly closely, and I think it's a sellout on a number of really basic points. So one is consumer protection, and that is now there's not going to be a consumer protection agency of any kind of independence. It's going to be buried in the Fed. And you can forget about any really control of credit card interest and honesty and transparency and all the things that were promised along the way, because the Fed, and you don't have to be a libertarian to believe this like Ron Paul, the Fed is in fact at the service of the banks. The banks pay the bill, the banks dominate the boards and so forth. And so forget that for consumers. The big real sellout here is not only did we not get a reversal of Glass-Steagall, but we didn't even get a meaningful Volcker rule. And if you want to say, I would say the main beneficiary right now is Goldman Sachs, which was allowed to become a bank to save its behind and to accept federal funds. And now Goldman Sachs doesn't have to divest anything. So the line between investment banks and consumer banks that are dealing with people's federally insured deposits, that's been totally obliterated. And this new law reinforces that instead of reversing it. So forget the Volcker rule. The limits on what the banks can do in terms of derivative trading are very limited. There are a lot of loopholes. For instance, they can still do a lot of the swap trading. They don't need to spin it off even to a separate affiliate of their own. They can do foreign trading. They can do interest rate trading and say, swaps. So I think in the main, it's a C-plus. C-plus.
Tony, before I get you in, isn't it true that Elizabeth Warren, who was the original author of this consumer agency idea, while she wanted it to be independent, isn't she still supporting it where it is in the Fed and thinks that it can work?
Well, I said it's a C-plus. You know, people can get through college with Cs. The point is, given the disaster that has visited the American consumer as a result of radical deregulation, given that you had an opportunity to protect the consumers across the board, that this is like a version of the healthcare. You had an opportunity to really do healthcare. You come out with, I guess, maybe a healthcare as a B minus or something. This one is very weak. And in fact, I think it opens new loopholes and validates the idea that a bank, that Goldman Sachs can be a bank and do exactly what they did as an investment house, and yet now we're on the hook for them. I think that's outrageous.
Tony?
I think that Robert and I are destined to play the part of two blind men, you know, trying to touch an elephant and figure out what the nature of the beast is. Robert's on the ivory, and I've found some other part of the anatomy, apparently. I think the Consumer Protection Bureau is much too strong, is going to basically have no one overseeing it other than the politicians who will be put on it. They'll be able to control definitions of mortgages, a lot of consumer assets that will be determined not on the basis of good banking principles, but on the basis of whatever the politicians who hold those jobs have. I think it's very dangerous. I think, however, that the chairman of the Senate committee, Senator Dodd, caught the flavor best of what we have has happened, and I'll quote him, quote, "No one will know until this is actually in place how it works." This is discouraging. You wouldn't want to get on an airplane where the builder of the plane says, "I don't know, we won't know until it's up in the air how well it's going to work." And I think that the raising of doubt is going to be a problem by itself. I do sense, and Senator Gregg of New Hampshire has been making this point loudly, emphatically, not loudly, that we are already in a credit contraction, and this is going to increase that, and so I think we're likely to see a greater likelihood of either a double dip in the economy, or at least a very even slower, sluggish growth, because this is going to make credit harder to attain.
See, I don't see that at all. I guess, but I do. I understand Dodd's point, because the biggest thing that's supposed to be the insulator or protector against a recurrence of, you know, the calamity that we've just gone through is what the higher capital requirements are going to be for the banks. And those are punted totally to the regulators. Now, when I've talked to experts about this, they say that's the smart thing. You don't want politicians, you know, saying that it should be 10% for these kind of banks and 12% capital requirements for these kind of banks. And I understand there's merit to that point, but it is a fact that the biggest protector of what we're expecting to come out of this is something that'll be determined, I guess, over the next 12 or 18 months as U.S. regulators, along with the international ones through the so-called Basel process, try to coalesce or harmonize what capital requirements are going to be for banks around the world. So the truth is, we don't know where the dust is cleared on what capital is going to be required. And that's the big capital is the thing that you have to protect if you end up making bad bets of whatever kind, so you can weather the storm without having to go to taxpayers for bailouts and having total meltdowns of the system. And you got to be clear, we don't know at all what capital is going to be required, except that everyone's holding hands saying we're requiring more capital. Bob's raising his hand, and I hear you breathily, Tony, through the air.
Let me say, you guys both worked in the government. I haven't. You know, I did work for the post office when I was going to college, but it's not the same experience. You've been in Washington. You know what these lobbyists can do with the regulators. And one test of this bill was, were we going to have a new regulatory agency that really had some teeth and some power, instead of all of these different agencies having a part of what Tony calls the elephant, you know, and fighting with each other and not having knowledge, and you don't like the SEC, you go over to the FDIC, you go here, you go there, and so forth. And they can whip these, as we saw with the oil drilling, they can whip these regulators around like crazy. The original hope was we were going to get a new agency that really had power. And that was also going to be true, by the way, consumer protection. I mean, for Tony to say there will be all kinds of people on the board protecting consumers, the banks don't think so. By the way, the response of Wall Street to this legislation is very optimistic. Goldman Sachs stock went up. They see this as providing certainty for their theft. They see this as now, I mean, if I were working for the bank now, I go in and say, hey, guys, we made out like bandits. We now have certainty that what we're doing is perfectly legal. Goldman will not have to give up anything, and will not have to go back to being an investment bank.
Go ahead, Tom.
Goldman Sachs obviously doesn't care about Consumer Protection Board because they don't deal with consumers. That's why, in fact, Blankfeld cheerfully mentioned that when he was testifying, that he, you know, since he doesn't have to deal with the small people, as another executive once said, it doesn't bother him, and it shouldn't. It should bother all the, you know, the 8,000 community banks around the country, and it should bother so many retail organizations other than automobiles who have been exempted, car dealers, from being able to provide the kind of loans that they think their customers need and they want to make loans for. We're now going to have politicians intermediating between the consumer and the loan officers. So
Tony,
I think
let me ask one thing, Tony, just on the consumer agency. Why is it such a bad thing if there were credit card agreements that people could understand? I can't read the credit card things that they send and understand that they can jump interest rates at whim whenever they want, or the mortgage documents. No one can understand it. Why is it a bad thing if people can understand that?
If all this was going to result in larger print and less words, it would be perfectly benign. I mean, although the reason you have a lot of words is because each possibility ends up getting litigated and then has to be dealt with in the next contract. But the problem isn't that. They're going to go much further than that, or they may go much further than that and make social policy based on the whims of the politicians. And this is inconsistent with good banking principles. But I want to make one point that
let him make his one point,
you, Matt.
Okay.
One quick point, Matt. When you said we don't know what the regulators are going to do, and I agree with you, of course, on that. However, the one thing we do know is that this is an attempt to protect ourselves against the catastrophic collapse that we had last time, and that the general process is to lean against in favor of lower returns, which means less economic activity. So the risk now is for low economic growth. And we've maybe reduced the risk of catastrophic collapse, but we've almost certainly reduced the chance of vigorous economic growth.
I think my guess is it's more a matter of degree, Tony, the differences we're talking about. But what about Bob? I want us to cover. There's other aspects of the economic news this week, but there's nothing on compensation reform, which continues to trouble me because if the folks who are running these firms get rich, whether or not their institutions end up performing or not, I think we're going to see people ending up with incentives to roll the dice again. And there's nothing, this is going to be left to boards of directors or activist shareholders or state controllers who control pension funds who can raise hackles about this. But there's nothing in there on this, Bob, is there?
Look, first of all, you guys are in basic agreement, and I think you're also in basic ignorance of how this thing really got going in terms of what, with the consumer. To suggest that Tony said it and you sort of laughed as if in agreement that the Goldman Sachs doesn't care about and doesn't involved with ordinary consumers is just utter nonsense. What do you think happens to credit card debt? What do you think happens to mortgage debt? It gets bundled. And Goldman Sachs was a major player in that bundling and selling and doing all the things with it. It is just simply untrue that that was the whole argument for deregulation. They're playing with rich people's money, and it'll be a victimless crime. That's not what happened. It didn't happen in Greece with Goldman Sachs. It didn't happen in our economy. And there is no real protection for consumers. Ordinary people who want to buy houses or take out credit loans or have credit cards or any of the things that go on. And in fact, my point about Goldman Sachs, let me be very clear about this. Goldman Sachs was allowed to become a bank, a commercial bank. And the great fear in those circles was that you would have to give something up because you're now playing in the area where ordinary consumers are involved. They don't have to give up anything here. Anything at all. So this is victory for the people who caused the problem.
Tony, quickly, then I want to move on.
You misunderstood. I didn't say that Goldman Sachs wouldn't have an effect on the little people. I said they don't have to do business with them. They don't make consumer loans. Yes, it's said, obviously, Goldman Sachs and banks like that are going to have their policies and actions are going to affect the world, but they don't have those transactions because they don't care what the deal is between the local banker
I just have to throw this point in. The reason we had a breakdown is the local banker then sold your loan and they were collateralized debt obligations and swaps were taken at them. No, you didn't get it because if you don't control what Goldman Sachs does with buying those loans, you're not controlling what the bank does in making the loan. It used to be the bank had to service the loan, was stuck with it for 30 years, and was responsible. There is nothing in this bill that will prevent them from doing exactly what they did before, which is allowing Goldman Sachs to take these mortgages, bundle them up, sell them, and everything else. There's just nothing in there. It does not solve the problem in any way.
It's not stopping securitization as a process. And I would argue that securitization itself is actually good for the economy. You need better regulations on doing it, but that's going to be a longer discussion another time. Let us know what you think about the financial regulatory reform at our blog at kcrw.com/LRC. I want us to spend a minute starting on another aspect of the economic news this week, because this all comes with Obama heading to the G20 in Toronto and real concerns about whether you can get the big nations coordinated to boost growth. You've got Britain this week putting out an austerity budget, saying that they're going to dramatically reduce their forecast deficits over the next 5 years, something that some folks in the U.S. are raising. But at least I think it's crazy to be worried about deficits, and I'm an old deficit hawk, before we are on the track toward getting unemployment down from these sky-high rates. Tony, briefly on this, then we got a break, then we'll continue.
Yeah, well, there's a split in the G20 between the United States that wants to have loose fiscal policy until the economy is growing better, and the Europeans, led by the Germans, who want to have tight fiscal policy to strengthen their sovereign bonds. Each country is going to do, or unit is going to do what they want to do, and there will not be unity at the G20, so we won't have a coherent world trading fiscal policy.
Up ahead, more on the economy, plus what next in Afghanistan. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller, columnist for TheWashingtonPost.com. Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief of TruthDig.com, is here. Tony Blankley, columnist for The Washington Times in Washington. We're talking about the economy. Bob, what do you make? I mean, there's clearly debate has heated up with Britain moving first on this, what looks like a pretty serious deficit reduction plan. As I was saying, I think we can't be – the idea that we're worried about the deficits in the near term when you've got so much unused capacity and 14 or 15 million Americans unemployed, many more underemployed, seems crazy. And yet that's what happened there. The Senate on Friday or Thursday said sort of ended the idea of doing an extra boost, no more unemployment extended unemployment benefits. And so it looks like they're sort of stopping that right now. And I'm very worried about this. What's your take?
Well, the issue is not everybody knows this. You shouldn't be spending a lot more money than you take in, and certainly not for a length of time. But you're absolutely right. If there's ever a time to do it is when you have a lot of unemployment and you're trying to get business going. The problem is, are you wasting money and running up these deficits, or are you using it wisely? And no serious questions were raised when we've thrown literally trillions of dollars. No questions are raised about the defense budget, where we don't have a sophisticated enemy in sight. Europe's cutting their defense budget. We in real dollars are spending more than at any time during the whole Cold War. So, conservatives are quite willing to run up big deficits for their programs. What was outrageous, the last time I looked, not a single Republican voted for the unemployment extension. And my goodness, if there's ever a program that helps the economy, if people are out of work, they are people who used to work, they're trying to find jobs, you give them that money and an unemployment check, you know you have the highest multiplier effect because they're going to go out and spend it. They need that money and they need to spend it. They're not going to put it in their mattress or something. The idea that we can't extend unemployment insurance, but we can extend all these benefits that continue, cheap money for the banks and what have you, is absolutely outrageous. And so the real issue should not be, once again, big government, small government, big deficit, small deficit. No, all of us would like to have government not have big deficits, of course. The problem is that this part of the political spectrum, the conservatives, are quite willing to run up enormous deficits for their programs, like making a needless war or bailing out banks, but they're not willing to do it to help ordinary people who are looking for jobs and can't find them, and now, by the way, are not going to be able to make their mortgage payments. And so we'll have an enormous problem with foreclosures, enormous problem with the housing market. This is going to exacerbate it, and 1.4 million Americans will wake up next week and not have an unemployment check.
Tony, what's your preferred, if you were benevolent dictator on the economy, what do you see as the path toward more jobs and fuller recovery if we're concerned about deficits?
Well, I think I'd abdicate the throne and leave it to somebody else. But if I were the benevolent dictator, but no, look, the Robert was talking about what we should be spending the money on and whether we should be borrowing now and how we spend it. The issue, I think, or one of the issues, is whether we're going to continue to be able to borrow the money at a reasonable rate. And Greenspan this week, I know the much discredited but recently master of the universe, Greenspan, said that we should be very careful that the resistance to purchasing sovereign bonds could come us very quickly. So the question isn't only should we spend our way out of this recession or this economic condition, but do we have the alternative of doing that, or are we going to face the possibility suddenly that we can't sell our bonds, as some European countries are having trouble with? And that's an entirely different question than whether whether Keynesian policy works or not, which is itself a debate. And of course, there are a lot of people, and I'm sort of not quite in that camp, but close to it, who wonder whether the spending on putting away the trillions of dollars of new debt that we take on by Keynesian policy, whether we've actually bought any solution. And that's what Robert was talking about. I'm not convinced we have. We may simply have spent $1 trillion and not improve the economy. So there are two separate questions. One, is the money available to be borrowed? And two, if it is, does it work?
I'm really glad you put that caveat out, or felt obliged to put in the caveat about how you referred to Alan Greenspan now, because when I think about him suddenly, and I saw the piece he did in the Wall Street Journal, I guess, talking about the day could be coming when we can't sell our our you know, government bonds. Alan Greenspan, back in 2001, was the one who, you know, his long-term prognostications were so savvy that he said there was a real worry that the U.S. would pay off its entire national debt if we continued to let the surpluses build up that Bill Clinton, with some help from Newton and others, I'll acknowledge, had bequeathed to President George W. Bush. And that became the rationale for these tax cuts that were, I think, unsustainable, crazy, unjust, and in lots of ways. I don't think we should be listening to Greenspan now. We do have to get on, though, to Afghanistan, because we are short on time, guys. We can't say everything on every topic that we want to. I want to invite our listeners to weigh in on where they think the economy is, the balance of deficits versus job growth, et cetera, at our blog at kcrw.com/LRC. But we do need to move on to Afghanistan because we have to have enough time to treat that. Obviously, huge news this week, the McChrystal flap, et cetera. Tony, what'd you make of it? Should this have happened, and whither Afghanistan?
Yeah, we don't need to move under Afghanistan. We're already there. We need to move out of Afghanistan. This was one of the messiest weeks in an American war, forced upon the president. He made, I think, in it, obviously the right decision to can the general. The general had certainly shown contempt, if not, I don't think he showed insubordination, but he showed contempt, and that's, Section 88 violation. I mean, it's up to, theoretically, you can have a courts-martial for showing contempt for your civilian chain of command. So there's no question that President Obama had to do what he did, I think. And I think that's a broad consensus. There are a few people who say no, but I think both Republicans and Democrats, hawks and doves, tend to agree that the president had no choice. The selection that he came up with to replace him is both brilliant and a little strange. It's sort of like asking Eisenhower to step down and replace Omar Bradley. And it's not that Eisenhower might not have made an excellent operational field general. There's a certain sense of weirdness that we had to turn to the top man and to get off his, you know, his out of his chateau and come down to the battlefield. Like, we don't have other generals who can do it. I have an unpleasant feeling about this. I think that we haven't solved the problem, because the problem is the strategy, and then the general McChrystal obviously made a hash of things. But even if he had made a hash of things, the problem of the conflict between the civilian bench, particularly Biden and a few others in the White House, who want to get out seriously in 18 months, now 9 months, or 12 months, I guess, now, and those, the Pentagon, who want to stay until the job's done. And until that's resolved, we're not going to have a coherent policy. And in fact, we've already convinced our ally, Karzai, that we are short-timers, and that's a big part of why we don't have a coherent policy.
Bob?
Yeah, well, look, the thing is falling apart, and actually McChrystal's fortunate to have been fired at this time, because what's really clear, and what I thought was a terrific Rolling Stone piece, I think they should get a lot of credit, was not the gaffes. What was there is that the policy is a disaster, and that the people, even around McChrystal, understand that the Afghans are not buying it. They don't want us to have their hearts and minds. When he tries to cut down the civilian damage, his own troops get upset because they feel unprotected, and you're in a classic quagmire, and no one can make a national security argument for it, because it's very clear that the Taliban right now is basically a homegrown entity that has no one can find any connection really between them and al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda seems to be happily ensconced elsewhere, and so one can't even justify Afghanistan in terms of our own national security. One has to make the case that it's somehow terribly important that we bring secular democracy to Afghanistan, this forlorn quest that Obama had campaigned against. And so that is really the issue. The problem in the selection of Petraeus is that he believes in that policy. And Obama stupidly, and I use the word advisedly, stupidly, in defending his firing of McChrystal, reasserted the policy in its most extreme form. The fate of the nation, our security, depends upon victory, winning in Afghanistan. What the heck is winning in Afghanistan? You're going to solve the problems of corruption, the alienation of people, the tribalism, the narcotics. And this is nonsense. And so it seems to me that the Rolling Stone article should have been a wake-up call saying, okay, let's talk about getting out quickly. If Petraeus is on board for getting out quickly, fine. And I might say, I mentioned before, NATO is pulling out. There's no question. We don't have allies any longer in this venture when you can't even control Poland. And they've served notice. Forget about it.
Yeah, the mystery to me, I agree with a lot of what you said, Bob. And the mystery to me is what McChrystal was really up to. And I guess I suppose we'll hear more from him at some point if, as the depressing pattern seems to hold, he'll hire, you know, Washington super lawyer Bob Bennett as his agent, and he'll be writing a book, you know, explaining the real story in Afghanistan within the next year and hitting the lecture circuit. But the idea, as I understand it, they were fact-checking this article. So there was like a whole process in the last couple of weeks. And the idea, even though most of this, if folks have read it, we should post the link on our site. If folks have read it, most of it is anonymous aides to McChrystal in the group, you know, with sort of locker room sniping about their superiors, which I'm sure takes place, you know, in every context everywhere. But the idea that he wouldn't expect that this would be the result of a large article in a magazine like this seems improbable to me, or it would be such a blind spot as to question his judgment in general. And from all accounts, he's an outstanding soldier and general, apart from sort of this kind of blind side. And so there's almost a part of me that suspects that somehow he was trying to engineer some kind of blow up through this, which is even more deeply troubling, especially in light of the fact that it's just not clear what at all. I agree with Bob. What we think success is in Afghanistan. We've reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center Rant, featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. Let us know what you think, by the way, about Afghanistan at kcrw.com/LRC. About 20 seconds each. Tony Blankley, it's your soapbox.
I want to come to Greenspan's defense when you made criticized the fine man for predicting surpluses when we have deficit. It assumed the current trends would continue. Current trends did not continue. September 11th came along. We started having to spend hundreds of billions of dollars we didn't expect on defense. The economy collapsed twice after in 2000 and again in 2002 and of course again now, and this has created the deficit. So to say the Greenspan misread events because the world changed dramatically in one of the great historic discontinuities is very unfair to a very fine man.
A lengthier rant, Bob. Our scientific precise rant measurement means you have at least 30.
Oh, so I'll try to make it a little more thoughtful than a rant. I actually,
but not more than 30.
I don't understand why this freeze on unemployment, extension of unemployment, isn't a bigger thing, and why we greet it with kind of the pundit's chuckle. If the three of us were depending upon our unemployment check to help keep our family going, food on the table, maybe pay the rent, you know, this would be a real big thing. And the idea that you, in a time of stark economic crisis, that every single Republican voted for preventing an extension of unemployment benefit is, to my mind, nothing short of outrageous.
On the deficit question, the right answer is to enact now a kind of proposal that would say once unemployment is down below, pick your number, 6% from near 10% where it is today, then Congress would require, say, a two-thirds vote to run budget deficits above, say, 3% of GDP, which most people think is the, you know, a sustainable level, as opposed to 10% as it is now. If we enacted something like that, it would signal to all our markets around the world that we're serious in the long term, but serious about jobs in the short term. That's all the jobs we have time for today in the Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to Robert Scheer and Tony Blankley. Sarah Spitz produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Pajamas.
I wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
But we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of all. Let's go.
You can podcast Left, Right, and Center, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog from our new media player at kcrw.com. Send questions or comments to our blog at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.